All right, folks, it's time to get started. So if everybody can take their seat. Again, if you kind of slide in to make sure there are a couple empty seats on the end, that would be really helpful. Just to make sure you're in the right place, this is Brewing and Fermentation in Ancient Civilizations, the History and Future of Biwak in Beer. So welcome. My name is Roxanne Westendorf, and I'm on the Brewers Association Board of Directors as one of the American Homebrewer Association reps, and I am also a member of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee for the Brewers Association. So I'm really happy to be here with you today. The standard stuff, I'm sure you've heard it a few times right now, but, you know, set these guys to stun. I know there's a Star Wars party later tonight, but set them to stun or put them on Do Not Disturb. That would be awesome. We're going to be taking questions via Slido. Hopefully you're familiar with that, but the screen will come up shortly so you can get to the appropriate Slido and do your questions there. It'll be a lot easier to get through them quickly. And don't forget, at the end of the seminar, there is a questionnaire on your CBC app that we would ask you to fill in feedback, and that's all about making next year better. But I think you're going to love this presentation, so I'm really excited. I'd like to just very quickly introduce you to the speakers, and I think get your lovely faces up there. All right, so first we have Celeste Beatty. She is founder, brewer and founder of Harlem Brew. Celeste?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just wait. All right, now we test my pronunciation lessons that I just had. Estela Davila from Mujeres Brew House, Border X Brewing. Did I do okay? All right. Ashley Randolph, founder of Brada Craft and Brews. And also one of the founding members of Lifting Lucy. Shyla Shepherd, founder and CEO of Bow and Arrow Brewing. Super pleasure to introduce somebody I work with on DEI committee, Trinice Watts, co-owner of Patuxent Brewing Company and also a Lifting Lucy co-founder. And just finally, a quick shout out to Sarah Perez from Maui Brewing Company, who is the third co-founder of Lifting Lucy. And take it away, Trinice.
I'm going to ask again, how are y'all doing today? Oh, we got a live crowd. Okay. All right. Well, again, I thank each and every one of you sincerely for coming. I really appreciate your time, and I know these amazing, talented women appreciate you as well. So I'm going to do something really, really quick and keep us on time, but I want you to raise your hand if you can tell me where North America is. Oh, we got some sharp people in the crowd. Okay. Raise your hand if you know where Africa is located. All right. Raise your hand if you know where Europe is. Asia. Where's the continent of black?
Everywhere.
Where's the continent of white?
Everywhere.
So please keep these things in mind. Keep your own nationalities, your ethnicities in mind as we have these conversations. I know we talk in black and white a lot, but do keep that in mind as we are all black and white presenting or brown presenting, all right? So I want to start with the first question about a woman's work in fermentation. As women of color in particular, we aren't always represented as... which one? What are you looking for? You want that? Oh, okay. We aren't always represented when it comes to being some of the originators of fermentation and brewing. And so the first question... Actually, before that, we're going to do a poll. Excuse me. Pull up the Slido. If you have it. And let us know, do you identify as a woman of color? Okay. All right, thank you. All right, so the first one. Even though we may not have been given credit for our creations, our innovations when it comes to fermentation and brewing. We want to discuss some of the ways where there's been expressions of fermentation, particularly where women reign, because it has always been a woman's work. It will always be a woman's work. And no disrespect to our beautiful brothers out there, right? But it really has been. So I want to discuss some of the ways in which women in ancient civilizations found themselves as brewsters. And I'd like to give that first question to Ashley.
All right. Afternoon, everyone. I'm not going to ask you how you're doing because we already know. But for me, when I really discovered and fell in love with craft beer, I felt like I was going to be one of a few. And then when I really started doing my research, I realized that I was one of many, millions, billions, actually, right, of women that have always had a hand in fermentation and brewing, whether it was a way of providing for themselves and their family by engaging in economic commerce. A beautiful story that I'm supporting right now. There's a few women in Malawi who, because of environmental conditions, no longer can sell fish. And they were in a position where they were having to utilize their womanly ways, for lack of a better phrase, to have access to this limited amount of fish. So not only are these women having to work, but they're having to literally sell themselves in order to provide for their families. And thankfully, there are a handful of them that realized, you know what, I know how to make beer. All these fishermen love to drink beer, so that's what I'm going to do. And this is something that we've done women all over throughout time. Also, it was a form of medicine. One of the first beer books that I read was on medicinal beers, and I was like, wait, this is a thing? Like, I don't have to take a pill. I can brew a beer with what I needed. And some of the recipes that I came across specifically were stories of women that would grow an herb garden, and they would ferment that in a rice beer, and it was a way for them to take care of them and their families. Brewing has also been a way for women to maintain cultural preservation. It's a way of socialization, hospitality, and diplomacy. The first time that I went to Fiji, I was introduced to the concept of kava. If you've never had kava, I highly recommend it. But it's a social thing. It's not rushed. You start at a low tide, which is your little sip-sip. Then as you get a bit more relaxed and your mouth starts going numb, you go up to medium tide. And then when you're completely laid out, you just have your high tide, right? So it's always been a way for women to keep that socialization. If you have a guest coming over, it's a way to offer them and welcome them into your home. For those of you that have done your part to repopulate the earth, thank you. I'm not a part of that club. But chances are, if you were having some challenges with milk production somewhere, whether it was an auntie or a grandma, told you, get a hold of some brewer's yeast. And there also is a component in barley that will boost your prolactin production. So it was a way for women to continue their essential role in their community as providers for their children to increase their milk production. And lastly, you know, it's what is a celebration without a beverage? So whether it was a wedding, a funeral, Trinise and I were joking about this the other night, you know, in our culture, African-American culture, we pour one out for the homies, right? And some people may see that as being, you know, de classe or ghetto, but no, it has a very rich tradition of pouring libations to our ancestors. The majority of those traditions are maintained and initiated by women. So in a nutshell, you know, beer has been a lot of things to a lot of people, but especially women.
Thank you. So next we're going to talk about brewing in African diaspora. And this question will go to Celeste Beattie. So we know of Ninkasi. She's a well-known beer goddess. I'm sure many of you know about her. But there was also Mbaba Mwana Waresa, the Zulu goddess of rainbows, fertility, and beer. And if you don't know her, I suggest you Google. But she, again, to carry on the tradition, she taught her community how to brew. And so we find this in researching that there were numerous women of color goddesses, not just the one that we know about. And Celeste, I would love for you to touch base just a bit more on the African diaspora of brewing and fermentation.
How much time do I have?
Hey.
There's a lot. Well, thank you, first of all, for being here. Thank you, Ashley, and everyone for putting together this amazing panel. I'm inspired just looking at everyone. The diaspora. For the past few years, I've spent a lot of my time in North Carolina on the eastern coast, Rocky Mount, hometown of Thelonious Monk and one of the greatest baseball players of all time, Buck Leonard, the Lou Gehrig of Negro Leagues baseball, and a lot of great women, many of them brewers. Growing up in the South, I spent quite a bit of time on my grandparents' farm in Wilmington, a historic town in terms of civil rights and agriculture. And I would hear stories and sometimes see the wine and beer and stuff that people were making. Some of it was being made for the monthly communion in the church. I'm like, really? Because, you know, a lot of the churches in the South, they just pour the grape juice. Anybody drink the grape juice for communion? I'm just saying. But then there were many communities there that actually made their own wine and beer and moonshine. And these were kind of secret stories because we live in the Bible Belt. You just didn't talk about those things. It was quiet. It was, you know, folklore, but you didn't hear about it. So for some time, I've just been collecting stories, not even intentionally, just finding myself at a backyard barbecue and simply asking the question, anybody in your family brew? And the hands would go up and the stories would start pouring out like you wouldn't believe. And when I think about the time I spent in a small village in Zimbabwe years ago, I had a chance to go there, and I'm always sniffing out beers like you sniff out the beer aisle in a grocery store. You know, just, where's the beer? What's going on? And I met these amazing women from a local tribe that make beer, much like what Ashley was speaking of, just, you know, from sorghum and millet and bananas. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. How long y'all been doing this? How long have you been homebrewing? Well, this is just what we do. We've been doing this. We don't even know. We don't even have a date on it. When they described and when I watched the way they were making the beer, you know, putting it into the containers that they use, mashing it, extracting all the sugars, sometimes adding corn and all these different things, I thought about the conversation I recently had, again, casually in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, about 3 weeks ago. I'm at a fundraiser, and I asked the question, anybody want to learn to brew? Anybody know anything about brewing? She said, yeah, my grandmother made beer. And the same process she described about taking the cornmeal and mashing it in water and then extracting the juice and all of the flavors and then setting it aside and letting it ferment was the exact same process that the women in that village described. And I'm like, wait a minute. This is amazing. And even though a lot of this stuff isn't written down, that story and that process survived the Middle Passage. It survived all of what happened throughout the history we know about of people from the African continent being enslaved and brought here. All those techniques survived. They didn't have a book about how to brew. My grandmother didn't have one. But the techniques of everything that was attempted to be brainwashed from them when they were, before they were put on the ships, there was this whole process that many of our African ancestors went through where they were basically forced to forget who they were. And I can tell you, when I do a side-by-side, I'm writing a book called Brewers in the Family. I've been working on it for a while because I didn't plan to write the book. But as I kept asking families about brewing, they were telling me all these stories. Like, we've got to share this. But when you do a side-by-side, you know, almost step-by-step of the women in this village that have been doing this for thousands of years to, you know, my aunt or a neighbor in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, in Bamberg, South Carolina, parts of Georgia, Florida, it's the exact same thing. And they don't have any of the books. You know, they don't know who Michael Jackson is. Maybe they know the one that sings, but they don't know, you know, this great guy who does. You know, they don't know this, but they have, these things have been passed down step by step, so much so that I sit there and I'm almost in tears. So I'm sure many of us experience as you're here to see how well preserved, not even in our DNA, but in our minds, the very steps that they learn growing up in the villages throughout the diaspora, surviving the Middle Passage, finding themselves in the Carolinas and all over this country, still doing those things. And has been one of the biggest sources of inspiration for me as a brewer to want to just keep doing it, because this isn't easy, is it? You know this is not easy. When I reflect on that history and I see how connected it all is, that is just an amazing thing. So I we'll touch on it a little bit more. I don't want to go on too long, but just ask people casually, do you brew? Do you know anyone that's brewing from the African diaspora or in general? And it's amazing how many stories are out there. I'm talking details. I'm talking sometimes I forget steps in brewing it. They know everything that was done from what their grandmother told them, the grandmother told the mother told the daughter or the son. It's all embedded within that folklore and when the history, the living history that we experience every day.
Thank you. Next, we'd like to discuss brewing in the Latin diaspora. And this question will be for Estella. So traditional beers such as chicha have recently been described as hidden, lost, or discovered. Is this the case? Did these traditional beers actually ever go anywhere? And just again, you know, tell us a bit more about just the Latin aspect of fermentation and brewing, please.
What's up, guys? I'm here for comic relief and also for the English challenged. Si alguien tiene una pregunta, yo les puedo ayudar. So, yeah. Chicha is a traditional corn beer that was made with wild plants, fruits, grains, and it was never lost or hidden. It just wasn't mainstream. Still isn't. But it was traditionally, well, it's still traditionally made in Latin America, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, you know, South America specifically. But it's a part of our culture. It's a part of our heritage. And it was never lost just because people didn't know about it doesn't mean it's lost. And luckily, younger generations are bringing it back now. So if you ever do have the opportunity to try chicha, it's a milky, viscous drink, but it's pretty tasty. You guys should check it out. So I'm here to talk to you about specifically Mexico. Obviously, I'm Mexican, first generation Mexican-American. And women were the original brewers in Mexico, and, you know, I'm Aztec and Mayan. Don't worry, I'm not going to sacrifice anybody today. We're all good. I'm going to talk to you guys more about pulque, which is one of the drinks that we still have in Mexico, and actually pulquerias are coming back. I was just in Guadalajara a couple weeks ago, and I was so happy to see a pulqueria where you can actually walk in and try this drink, and it's just... it's amazing, and pulque is attributed to mostly Mayan, but it's also Aztec, and this drink is also, it's a fermented beverage, obviously, like tezguino and pozol, mezcal, tequila. These are all of our traditional drinks that we still have, and like I said, if you ever have an opportunity to try any of these, please try them. So pulque was specifically attributed to Mayahuel, which is the goddess of agave, maguey. But there's a couple other stories of how it originally got started. My actual favorite is one of the tlacuache, which is an opossum. And he is known as the maker of rivers. The tlacuache would make very straight rivers until he discovered with his like little human hands when he dug into a maguey that there was what's called aguamiel. And which means honey water, and it was pulque. So when he would drink pulque, obviously he was a little tipsy, and the rivers went crooked. So he was going from basically cantina to cantina, making rivers a little crooked because he was drinking pulque. So that's my favorite story of how it came to be. But obviously there's a bunch of other traditions, a bunch of other stories, and for me, it's a little bit different because I don't brew. I would never say that I brew. I happen to help Sam, my amazing head brewer. She's sitting right over there, Sam Wilson. And So Carmen and myself, which is my partner, she's sitting right over there. We started...
there you go.
Yeah. We started Mujeres Brew Club, which was basically a club to basically empower and educate specifically women of color, Latinas, about independent craft beer. we wanted to just get more women into the craft beer aspect. So we started a club. Every month it was a different topic. We would invite a different brewery. They learned from the history of beer all the way to actually making a beer. And the club got extremely popular. We started a second chapter in Los Angeles, and then the pandemic hit, so we couldn't have our meetings anymore. Carmen one day was on the phone with me, and she said, we should take over that brewery that's shut down. 24 hours later, we have keys in our hands somehow. So that's how Mujeres Brew House happened. True story. another thing that, you know, I really want to speak on is that it's a social thing to make beer. You know, we welcome anybody that wants to learn about making beer, and we want to teach and empower and educate anybody who wants to learn beer. Not women specifically, you know, don't think because the name is Mujeres Brew House, that's women only. We like the guys too, you know. Yeah. So it's more about, you know, the culture and the immersion. And unfortunately, when beer was brought over to Mexico, there was a lot of myths that started about pulque, which is the reason why pulque kind of disappeared. What happened was they would say that they would put monitas in the pulque, which is a little doll, and that it was filled with animal or human feces, and that's how it would ferment. So if you drank pulque, you were gross. You were, wow, you were of lower value. You were of, you know. So that's why pulque kind of disappeared. So obviously that never actually happened, but that's how it kind of went away. So, you know, like I said, if you ever have a chance to try it, please do. It's delicious. I'm going to pass it over to you, girl.
Thank you. Next, we're going to talk about, and again, because of certain aspects, a lot of this is intercultural, inter-ethnicities and stuff, but brewing in the Native North and the Mesoamerican diaspora. And we're going to talk with Shyla. How you doing?
All right.
And Shyla, could you just, again, we wanted to, again, people's native to this land here in the U.S., have been brewing and making beer long before Europeans arrived. So how can we honor the oldest brewing traditions of what we now call North America or Central and or Central America, in your views?
Sure, thanks. It's great to be here with all of you today. Thanks for having me. So again, a little background on myself. I'm co-founder and CEO of Bow and Arrow Brewing. We're based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. A member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation over on the Fort Berthold Reservation in western North Dakota. I grew up on the prairies of North Dakota, studied economics in the Bay Area, and I worked as a social impact investor for almost a decade in the Southwest before starting Bow and Arrow. And I'll start with sharing a little history today. This week we're gathered as an industry to share information, educate ourselves, and inspire each other. But I also want us to keep in mind that, you know, we're gathered here on the traditional homelands of the Dakota and the Anishinaabe people.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's important. We've got about 10 minutes, and I'm going to hit on three points here. One is just sharing a few of the examples. Estelle shared some of them of, you know, traditional fermented beverages found here in the Americas. I think it's a common myth that Europeans brought alcohol to the Americas, so I think it's important to be aware of some of the traditional beverages that were being produced here before and that held a lot of cultural and social significance. So I'll hit on a few of those examples. There's some overlap, but I think she spoke to Chicha amazingly, so I'll just hit on some of those. Also, I'll share some of, there's a lot of information out there on, you know, what we do at Bow and Arrow, but I think in the context of coming through, you know, a very challenging last couple of years, I'm going to share with you some of the things that really kept us grounded and focused. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about beer as a force for good and one of the initiatives that we launched late last year that we're in the process of ramping up, ramping down, winding down at least the first iteration of. So back to the question, how do we honor our fermentation histories and traditions? First and foremost, I think it starts with acknowledging that that history exists. You know, again, I mentioned that pervasive false narrative that alcohol was introduced to us. But again, if we look back across history, we find the ingenuity of indigenous people led to the domestication of corn, to the domestication of the cacao tree. And some researchers go so far as to reason that the impetus for the domestication was likely for the production of alcohol from, you know, sweet fruit pulp from various sugar sources. So when we begin to dig in and research various cultures the world over, we see that humans have sought out ways to produce and enjoy fermented beverage throughout history. So I think that's a common thread we have across many different cultures. In the context of North and Meso or Central America, again, there's a number of examples of fermentable sugars sources that were used. Again, corn, which started as a, you know, a mountain grass that was eventually domesticated so that there was a single stalk, many kernels. And we also have cacao, you know, Mayan fermented beverages as well. And really, you know, berries from the Peruvian pepper tree, prickly pear, you name it. If it had sugar, people figured out how to make a fermented beverage from it. So again, to reiterate that ingenuity of indigenous folks in that evolving into many different fermented beverages. Estelle mentioned chicha. And again, like that, again, took some ingenuity. You know, early on, they would actually roll the balls of corn flour in their mouths because they understood that those enzymes would break down those starches into sugars. And then later versions of that, in the Southwest, for example, Apache folks actually, they would basically malt the corn, so they'd soak it overnight. That would start to sprout, and then they would, you know, mash it in, and that was basically a corn beer that they enjoyed. I think, you know, in doing research for this panel, you know, it got me really thinking about some of this history that maybe hasn't been really widely shared. And, you know, as a Native person, I realize there's still a lot of pervasive, you know, stereotypes and racism that come into play when I start researching these articles that talk about indigenous or Native people and alcohol, which just shines a very different light on us, and it's usually pretty negative. So I think a lot of Native folks over time have kind of taken pause to share some of that history. And there's still, I think, like a lot of shame involved. So I think, you know, doing what we're doing, sharing our stories, presenting it in really, you know, beautiful ways, and sharing the narrative around, you know, the ingredients we use, the thought and care we take when we forage ingredients, like Navajo tea, all of the ways that we operate bow and arrow, it's hard. Yeah. Thanks. This is a conversation that's sort of always just beneath the surface, but I think it's important we have it, we get it out there, we understand what these long-held, harmful stereotypes and myths are, and we break them down. So we focus a lot on that as far as, like, these things that sustain us at Bow and Arrow. And what I've learned is some of these things actually have made us kind of unique. So things like foraging for ingredients, we've really taken the last couple years to reconnect with the land. We have an orchard on our property. We have a very large garden where we grow heirloom produce, both from where I'm from as well as Navajo. And we look for ways to incorporate those into our beer. So it's really, you know, I see it as keeping ourselves grounded, but it's also, I realize, an important part as we start to talk about long-term sustainability is we look locally, we look at what's around us, and we value that. I think a lot of times things that are in our backyards we take for granted. So, you know, we're really focused on doing those things, like foraging for wild New Mexicanus hops in the mountains of New Mexico. That's something that we've started to do every year. And it's okay if it's a small batch. It still shares a story and shines a light on things that are of value right underneath our noses. We also really value reaching out and collaborating with local partners, Native people when we can. You know, our economies have had a lot of hardship, especially on reservation-based areas, communities. So whenever we can, we seek out those, you know, vendors and suppliers from those communities. Things cost more for them to do what they're doing. They're usually pretty remote. A couple examples of those for us include we've sourced sumac berries from Navajo Agricultural Products Industries. One of our core beers is called Denim Tux. It's an American Pilsner. And we source, thank you, our blue corn from the Santa Ana Pueblo. And they're just about 20 miles north of the brewery. So they actually have a mill there. Mm-hmm. So they roast it and crack it to our specs. And we do pay a higher price for that, and that's okay. But I think sharing those stories and also this desire to, you know, look for ways to be more sustainable is a really important conversation for us to be having and to be thinking about as we move forward as an industry as well. So yeah, there's examples out there of indigenous fermentation. But what I've realized is I think we've only scratched the surface. I think there's still a lot of history and traditional practices for us to uncover. There's still some scientific research being done even around Chaco Canyon and some of the pottery shards that have been discovered there using things like gas chromatography, mass spectrometry. So some of those things are happening right now as we speak. So I'm really excited to stay on top of that. And share that as I learn more as well. Those are some examples of what keep us excited.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah,
why don't you touch your native land? Don't stop now, girl. Just touch on it really quickly if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of beer as a force for good, as a force for change, an initiative that we launched last year during Native American Heritage Month in November was the Native Land Collaboration. It's really become, you know, something bigger than I even initially hoped for. And that's thanks to, you know, you, our craft beer peers, for joining us and supporting us and shining a light on the history that's here. It's all around us. And also in committing to, you know, donate proceeds from these sales to impactful Native nonprofits. So for those of you who may not be aware of what Native Land is, we launched it last November. We developed the IPA recipe, the label, so it's in line, you know, with really great, powerful movements like Black is Beautiful, like Brave Noise. So it's really around creating awareness and resources. And in this case, it's for Native folks. So on the label, we ask that participating breweries do some research and figure out on whose ancestral land they're brewing on. We have two breweries here in the Minneapolis area that joined us, Dangerous Man and Wooden Ship. So that was really awesome. So they, on their label template, they acknowledged, you know, they're on Dakota and Anishinaabe land, and then, again, committed to donate proceeds to Native nonprofits. And we really kind of focused on those doing work around land stewardship and also just more generally contributing to, you know, strengthening Native communities. We ran that through this about this point for this first go-round of Native Land, we had, I think, about 58 breweries commit to produce it. We've had 41 releases so far. And as far as reported numbers, in aggregate, we've donated just over $40,000 to Native nonprofits.
Excellent. Excellent.
So Native Land has been really impactful, not only for the dollars, but in creating awareness for the Native folks, you know, in those areas, but also for those of us who are in the industry, you know, whether you're working back of house or front of house, to really, truly kind of feel seen and included. So thank you, everyone who's participated, who knows about it, who shared the story. Thank you.
Thank you, Shala. So this question is first going to go to Ashley, and then it's really for everyone here on this panel, talking about brewing in the Asian and Polynesian diaspora. So the question, archaeologists in southeastern China recently discovered the residue of beer drunk 9,000 years ago. What expressions of beer and its origination are not being explored and authentically honored when you think it comes to like a Asian or Polynesian, the diaspora?
So actually, Trinise, can you hold that up for 1 second?
Can you see?
I want everybody to take a good solid 20 seconds and look at this image, right? Create your own story connected to this image, and we're gonna come back to it in a second. I am not a member of the Asian diaspora, nor the Pacific Islander diaspora. And I really just want to take a minute to acknowledge that for me, my research and elevating these stories was an exercise of cultural appreciation. If you were not here for Lindsay's panel before us, you missed out, please go back and rewatch it. And it's very important, and I very much respect that I have this sisterhood and relationship with Lindsay where I was able to speak with her and get information on her culture and related cultures. And the same thing with Anu from Maui. I know we have some Maui people in the house, right? So for me, it's really important that I acknowledge that this is not my culture. It's not something that I have an intimate firsthand knowledge with. And so I had to do the work to educate myself, and it was an honor to educate myself on the stories of my sisters from this diaspora and share their stories with you all. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Thank you.
Go ahead. So with that picture that you just looked at, did any of those persons in there look like fairies to you? Tinkerbells, unicorns, mythical creatures? Anyone? No. What did they look like to you? Okay. Women. Thank you very much. Okay. So that image represents Tojis, and Tojis were masters of sake. Now, depending on who you ask historically, the origins of sake trace back to the 6th century, right? But instead of acknowledging the women who toiled and sweat and spent time away from their families to make this beverage that an entire culture appreciated, it was much more easier to sanitize the story and say, oh, there was this mythical fairy that was so dainty and delicate, and, you know, she just had a little dribble of saliva that dropped down. But because she was so magical, it was this fermented beverage called sake, right? So instead of acknowledging the hard work, you know, they Disneyfied it, for lack of a better phrase. And so that, for me, was very heartbreaking to hear this erasure of my sisters and my foremothers from a different culture, that their legacy was removed from them. In addition to that, I know that I am a Toji. I know there's a lot of Tojis in the room, and y'all might be looking at me like, what the hell are you talking about, Ashley? And I'm going to explain in a second. So the literal translation of a Toji is an independent woman and or the female master of a house. Okay, I'm going to channel my inner Beyonce. How many independent women we got in here? How many independent women we got in here? How many women are holding down households? Okay? Congratulations, you're all Tojis. All right? And so to hear where there was a legacy that began with acknowledging these women that were truly masters of their craft and their families and their households and ultimately their community, to now, very similar to brewing history here in America, which we won't go into, realizing that it could be mass-produced and monetized, and now this is no longer sacred work. It's now men's work. It's dirty work. And so very much how you were saying with pulque, there was this campaign to bastardize and you know, really just sully this beautiful thing. And so it was perceived as, you know, you as a woman, you're delicate. You're dainty. You shouldn't be sweating. You shouldn't be carrying these heavy things. And so there was a whole generation or two that was lost of these tojis because now it was seen as not the womanly thing to do. So that was really deep for me. I'm very happy to see that we have some modern tojis of this specific background that are reclaiming their time and their space in brewing. And so I'd like to shout out Carol Pak from Maku. Which is Korea's oldest brewery. She's running the helms there. Manit Shohan, who here is like me and watches Food Network at 3 o'clock in the morning because you're hungry, right? Okay, little known fact, Manit, who is an Indian-American restaurateur, her and her husband have several breweries on one property. And then we also have Kaori Oshita from Minho Beer in Japan. So there are women all over the world reclaiming our space, reclaiming the fact that this has always been in us. It's been a part of our heritage, our mother's heritage, our grandmother's heritage. But specifically to this diaspora, I want to elevate their names. And that's really, truly, shameless plug for a second, that's what Lifting Lucy is all about. For those of you who are not familiar, Lucy is the anglicized name of the oldest human remains that were found. That woman's name was not Lucy, I guarantee. I bet my house on it wasn't Lucy. But what I do know is that that woman had some degree of fermentation knowledge, as did her sisters, her mothers, her grandmothers. So just want to throw that out there. Slightly shifting to a culture that I am a bit more familiar with intimately, born and raised in Vegas. And Vegas is the official ninth island of Hawaii because we have such a huge diaspora there. And as I shared a little while ago, the first time I had kava was when I traveled to Fiji. And the more research that I did into why kava exists, how it's produced, I never saw a man making kava. The only time I saw men in relation to kava was when they were completely, like, everybody's grown, completely shit-faced. Because because being men, they wanted to prove themselves, and they went high tide instead of going low tide, right? And then the more research that I did, in Samoa, there's a beverage by the name of Fa Amafu. And we all know the legacy of colonization, so I won't belabor on that too much, but very similar to the history that Lindsay shared with us in the previous session. When you had colonialism, let's call it what it is, colonization, truth be told, and the implementation of Christian standards, you know, these communities were literally told, you cannot drink alcohol. Because when you drink alcohol, you're going to get rambunctious, and we need you docile, so you can toe the party line and do what we need you to do. Well, the beauty in all of this was, and very similar to my culture, where in African-American culture, we weren't allowed to get married when we were on the plantation. So we literally had to jump over a broom and make the plantation owners think that we were playing a game in order to reclaim our own lives and create our own families. And very much in that same vein, the fermentation of Fa'amafu was a beverage that they fermented, but because the powers that be at the time didn't recognize it as a beverage, they were able to continue their tradition. So that was really, really impactful and powerful for me. Lindsay touched on a little while ago the legacy of Dole and the just complete decimation of Hawaiian culture at that time. And it literally was illegal to speak any language, to write any language outside of English. And I think it was very important to be mindful when I was preparing for this is that as a lot of traditional cultures, things weren't written down. It was a legacy of storytelling. And so if you were in a system where you were placed in school where you couldn't speak your native tongue, you have that disconnect from you and your grandmother or your tias or your aunties who didn't speak the same language as you. And so a lot of that tradition was lost. And Anu, I really want to thank her for being so open and sharing and helping me prepare for this. And I'm going to reference a quote from her. Give me one second here. Before I get there, sorry, I skipped over. So, again, a lot of overlap, I'm sure, probably in your community, our community as well. We had those soldiers that fought for the preservation of our culture. And so a lot of people on the islands would meet in secret and had secret organizations to make sure that they were able to pass those traditions on. So that was just very impactful and powerful for me to know that they were so committed to keeping their culture alive, which fermentation was a big part of it, that they were willing to risk, you know, potentially jail, fines, or anything else to keep it alive. So in Hawaiian culture, there is a concept of ma'alama. Yeah, okay, ma'alama. And I asked Anu what ma'alama means to her, and she says it means to take care. Essentially, it's to take care. And for her, living in Hawaii, it refers to taking care and respecting everything around you, whether it's the land, your community, your family, etc. Being in the brewing world, for her, it's something that doesn't just refer to beer that you're actually brewing, so taking care of the end product. More importantly, it refers to taking care of your teammates, the materials around you, sourcing them responsibly, the vessels that you're using to ferment them, and most importantly, the newcomers who are coming to you to get that shared knowledge and history and legacy. So that was very, very powerful for me. She goes on to say, in order to create something great, one must take care of all aspects and put all of your positive energy into it. This is how we, as Lindsay, please forgive me, Kanaka Maoli. Thank you. Appreciate you. We're taught to work and put our aloha in everything. Mm-hmm. And so for all of us in this room, for those of you that know me, I don't know strangers. We're all kinfolk, so I'm going to hold you accountable, and I'm going to challenge you. How can you leave here and take this concept and this way of life of ma'alama into craft beer in the community as a whole, but especially locally at your brewery?
Thank you. Thank you, Ashley. Sorry, I'm going to try to stay on time. I'm going to start with Celeste, if you don't mind. How are modern Black, Indigenous, and other beautiful women of color, such as yourselves, ensuring their culture has a place in the modern craft beer world? How do you solve world peace in 1 minute? Go.
So what? Could you repeat that again, please? How? I know I got it. I just want to make sure I...
How are you ensuring that people like us, people like you, women of color, have a place in the craft beer world?
Yeah, so there's a lot going on. I have to figure out how to, because it's a lot.
Yeah.
I was in a conversation yesterday. Okay.
He made it.
Sorry.
It's good.
Okay. Yeah. Hope he's okay. Safety first. Yeah. Okay. My journey in this has been really focused around culture. And everyone's touched on it here. In fact, I reached out to you may recall, when you first started and said, let's collab. And a big part of the reason why I did that is because so much of what you just said, and I was in tears too, resonates with my whole experience in craft brewing, particularly as it relates to the sensitivities and the just the stigmas attached to Black people in beer and Indigenous people in beer. It's a terrible thing. I've been called a sinner. I've been pointed out on the streets of Harlem. That's her. She's trying to open up that brewery. And, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you bringing beer to Harlem? Why are you doing this? We don't need beer. And it's been a difficult thing for me for many years, and many of us in our communities, because of the stigma, when there's unbelievable now information out there about the nature of our traditions and information about how deeply embedded beer culture is within our culture. And it's just been, you know, it's just been really tough to, I mean, I've debated people about, you know, we've had this conversation, whether Jesus drank wine or beer, I'm sure it's beer. I've had people get angry with me for saying it's beer because, you know, it was beverage of the people. You know, just having conversations about it, as you probably read the story a couple of times, I've had to go to ministers and get their support so that I could continue to be in the community talking about beer. But I would just say, to answer the question, let me get to that. It's always been important to me to look at beer, particularly with the sensitivities around it, as a platform to elevate and celebrate culture. Starting in Harlem, so much culture, you know, the epicenter of African diasporic culture and culture of the world. So much of it is embedded there. So looking at beer, it's very social. There's a lot of activities and events. Harlem Week, you know, 125th Street, you know, Lenox Avenue, Malcolm X Boulevard. That's just what it is. And going there and being told it's dangerous, you're going to get killed, don't go. People laying hands on me, wanting to pray and make sure I'm going to be safe. I mean, just negativity, a lot of just total misconceptions about the culture. So for me, you know, looking at, you know, not only the label, but the events, the activities, the organizations we could support and highlight and build awareness for has always been just number one for us in terms of that. And I was saying this in one today, I think craft beer, so many of us in this room, we really have a unique opportunity at this time in our country and our world to look at our spaces and places as businesses and environments where we can talk and share our culture and share the things that are important to our community. So a lot of what we do are many, many charitable events. We get calls all the time for beer. They want us to donate beer. They want us to support their events, and I only make so much beer. But I just think it's so critical right now in every way we possibly can, with so much need and so much challenges in our communities economically and socially, to do everything we can to highlight the organizations, to highlight the events and activities, the schools even. You know, the schools reach out to us. You know, beer helps raise money. You know, it's a platform where we can not just share what we love to make, but we can create a space to talk about these things. So for me, answering the question, yeah, about culture and what place it plays, I just think the two are connected. I think it's imperative that we use the platform as much as we can to shed a light and uplift and celebrate culture in all the ways we can.
Thank you, Celeste. Did anyone, we have a few minutes to do some Q&A, but I want to also do another Slido, just because, again, we need to learn ourselves so that we can always do better. Did you learn anything today? I'll give you a few seconds. And then the next question, and please be honest so we can help. Do you feel empowered to lift women of color up in your own communities? Okay, so some of you are feeling, okay, sort of. You need some resources. And thank you for your honesty with these questions. There we go. And then, again, we have a few minutes. Do we want to do some Q&A, take some questions?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I'm sorry, they're not coming up on my screen, is it? Nope. It's not on there.
questions?
All right, so the first question I have, would you be willing to offer suggestions as to how folks who don't identify as BIWOC can support efforts to renew traditions without being appropriative? Anyone want to take that one quickly? Sure, I'll repeat it. Would you be willing to offer suggestions as to how people who aren't BIWOC or don't identify that way, how they can support efforts to renew traditions, but doing it in a way that's appreciative?
Renew?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Well, I guess one suggestion is I'm sure, you know, some of these efforts are underway being led by, you know, people of color, so I think amplifying and supporting those efforts is really important. So really, I guess when it comes to these conversations, I forget what the term is, like not about us, without us is kind of what people of color say. So I think taking a more supportive role in, you know, amplifying and sharing some of the efforts that are already underway, I think is really important, as opposed to like, let's just, I don't know, produce this product with this image on it, and it's like inspired by these people, but they're not involved in the narrative or the story or the design. I think, you know, that's something to kind of be mindful of.
Thank you. Another question we have. When using history, heritage, and legacy in your naming and branding, and I think this was kind of what you just touched on already, what things should be kept in mind, and I'll give it to you, Estella, to be respectful, mindful, informative, and fun when it comes to naming and branding. So I'll say it one more time. When using history, heritage, and legacy in your naming and branding, what should you keep in mind to be respectful, mindful, and informative, but also fun?
I think for just speaking as a Mexicana, don't have a Cinco de Mayo party if you don't know what it is. So real quick, Cinco de Mayo isn't celebrated in Mexico, but it's very much celebrated here. Have a Mexican Independence Day party, 16th of September, you know, look into the 20th of November, find out what that is. You know, these are other dates that are very important to us and actually mean something to us. But maybe because Corona wants to sell some more beer, Cinco de Mayo is a thing. So I think more than anything, just do your research and really find out what it is and why you're doing that specific thing. You know, it's just 2 minutes of research and you're going to say, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Or, I do want to do that, you know, just really look into it and figure it out why it is that you want to do this, or reach out to that specific community and say, how is it that I can help you guys? What is it that I can do? You know, do you need help with maybe a specific thing? How can my brewery help you? You know, and same thing with women. If you welcome us, we drink, guys. We drink a lot. So just maybe, you know, have something that's a little geared towards women as opposed to just, you know, guys, and that would help because, I mean, my brewery, any given day, there's way more women there than there is men. Way more women. And, but yeah, I think it's about just making it a safe space for everybody, a very safe space for everybody, you know. Be considerate of everybody that you want to be in your space and you want to feel welcomed. So, yeah, that's...
Thank you. Celeste, I want you to touch on that just real quickly as well. When using history, heritage, and legacy in your naming and branding, what are some things that need to be kept in mind for respect, mindfulness, informative, and just for making sure it's fun as well?
I think you touched on pretty much what I would say. I was going to kind of take another facet to it. Something that's bothered me for years. Does anyone in the room know what Juneteenth is? So I see a lot of people jumping on Juneteenth. I mean, I think it's great. One of the things that's kind of bothered me about how Juneteenth is beginning to be celebrated, which I think is great that more people are celebrating, it's a beautiful thing. But I think that when we think about Juneteenth, the Emancipation Proclamation, and that whole period, it was freedom. It was about freedom for African diasporic people. But have you thought about the fact that it was also freeing the minds of the people that may have participated in enslaving us and those that did not? I just think it offers a really interesting opportunity for us to have a conversation about that about what happened during that period. So I think Cinco de Mayo, I definitely get what you're saying about that. It's always bothered me. But I think Juneteenth and talking about DEI, diversity, inclusion, equity, I think there's a lot of great ways that people can support more organizations economically. And I'm just going to do a shout out for Black Brewers. Black Brewers need money. I mean, I'm not trying to say anything disparaging about any of the black and brown brewers need money. We all, yeah. There are so many ways that you can really look at increasing more diversity and equity and inclusion by helping get some breweries established. And you know, I just looked at all the beautiful equipment out there, the piping, the glycol system, you know, all that stuff. It takes money. And I think one of the things that we can do, and I'll be quiet, is let's look at some alternative things out here. We know about collaboration beers. That's breweries coming together doing some really cool collabs. What about breweries coming together in some of these beer deserts and putting some money together to intentionally help open breweries there with black and brown ownership? Anybody interested in that? Let's talk.
Y'all trying to drop the mics out here today. Okay. I'm going to go for one more until they kick us out, because there's some excellent questions here. And I'll let anyone take this one. In what ways have you had to command respect in a room where you didn't feel there was a seat for you?
I'll take this one quickly. The concept of having a seat at someone else's table, I think it's a necessary evil, especially for those of us that are looking to find a way back to what's always been a part of our culture in this industry. And now I'm of the mindset that I don't want a seat at your table if there's not a place set for me already. Instead, I'm building my table with my sisters, where you're not only going to be fed, you're going to be loved on, you're going to be hugged on, you're going to be nurtured, you're going to be inspired, you're going to be educated.
You're going to get you drunk, too.
Well, that too.
And we're going to drink some brews, yes.
But beyond that table, very much to what Celeste just mentioned, I'm interested in establishing a foundation where there is a home for everyone to come, not only to be at the table, but to have space to create, to produce, to inspire, and educate. So to answer the question directly, I think for me, education is at the root of true equity, because if you're not educated enough in what it is that you're wanting to do, you're going to have a hard time going to obtain those resources. So take time, educate yourself, because when you show up in any room, it doesn't matter what you look like. What people cannot take away from you is your intelligence and your passion. So let them underestimate you. When people underestimate anyone, they will tell you everything you need to know and put that in your back pocket, quietly excuse yourself, and go kick ass.
Yeah. As you've been doing. We're going to do one more, and then I'm going to encourage everyone to please, if you have any more questions, just come on up and chat with them. But the last question I'm going to ask, Shyla, how does one join the Native Land Initiative?
Yeah, we are just wrapping it up, actually. But given how well I think it's been received, and I think the potential impact, the opportunity for more impact beyond, you know, this first round, we're taking back kind of what we've learned. We're getting feedback from participants. And we will likely launch the second round starting in November during Native American Heritage Month. We do have a page on our website. We have an Instagram page for Native Land as well, where we highlight participants, some of the nonprofits who've benefited from proceeds, and we just kind of keep ongoing updates there. So look out for round two of Native Land this November.
Awesome. Thank you, Shiloh. Listen, I want each and every one of you in here right now to know that we love you, we appreciate you, we thank you for being here, and please, again, if you have a question, come on and ask. It's not hard. We ain't scary. So thank you, everyone.